session number 10693, rule 8.
Colonel Lawman, Reel 8. What were your personal duties at Shanhai Quan?
Well, I was simply I was in charge of my company. What we did, I simply can't remember, but there was a lot of fun on horses and things like that. We used to hire ponies and get the soldiers to ride them, give them lessons. Peter Lewin was very good at this. And used to give them riding lessons. And we swam. And we had manoeuvres up in the hills, too. I can remember the colonel came up, much to our displeasure, and we had a sort of exercise up in the hills beyond Shanhai Quan town, if you can call it a town. We camped out there and we did various manoeuvres, about which I can remember almost nothing at all, except I had to go and get the battalion pay, or it might have been the company pay, and I had to ride on a horse to get it to Ching Wang Tower, where was the bank where the money was held. I remember being thrown from my pony en route. Luckily I had a groom, a Ma Fu, with me on a pony, and that was all right, and I didn't hurt myself. But to go and fetch the battalion pay on horseback in 1939, looking back now, it seems really rather ridiculous. Having done it in all other places, in lorries with an escort and so on.
Was your Ma Fu Chinese?
Oh, yes. I had, how many ponies did I have? I had two ponies in Peking and Tientsin. I can't remember these. These couldn't have been mined down in Shanhai Quan, I don't think. We had a regimental point-to-point always every year. And there was just before the war started, one of these officers who was sent home to do a course had a pony for sale. And he'd bought this pony in order to win the regimental point-to-point, which he duly did, much to the fury of the commanding officer who thought he was going to win. And I bought this pony off this chap when he was sent home. It cost me, I think, either 70 or 75 pounds, and it was the most expensive pony in the regiment. And I used to play polo on it in Peking.
Was it worth the price?
Oh, rather, yes. And it was a jolly good pony. It was a mare, and rather outstanding in many ways. But the extraordinary thing was, I could not even give it a lump of sugar without its rearing up and trying to strike me. In order to get on to the thing, it had to have his head covered, her head covered. And then after I got on board, everything was absolutely marvellous. It couldn't put a step wrong. And a friend of mine, another industrialist, he was a coal mine man up in Peking, he said, "You must race that pony." So I said, "All right, you train it and I'll ride it," which I did, and I only rode it in two races, I think, and then the war started, and both of them I came in second. This was in Peking, a race course up there, and I think it might have been ridden in Tientsin as well by somebody else, but I can't remember that. But it gave me enormous pleasure. And ever since then, I gave up betting, because the first time I ever rode in a race, I went into the jockey's changing room and I heard them talking about Norman's horse. None of them knew who I was. And they said, "I think Norman's horse is going to win." I hadn't a clue whether I was even going to get round. And in fact, I came in second. So I thought, well, if the jockeys don't know what's going to happen, what's the point in ever betting? And I've never betted since, except once, and that was a Derby in 1960, and I backed Churchill's horse, which was scratched. And I switched the bet to, what's his name, Lester Piggott's horse, and won. And I've never betted since. But that's beside the point.
Where were you when the war in Europe broke out?
In the embassy in Peking. and all by myself. I didn't stay there very long after that, because that was September. And by Christmas, we were in Hong Kong, mobilising.
The whole battalion was moved to Hong Kong, was it?
The whole battalion. We were relieved by the East Surrey Regiment. Instead of having battalion headquarters in Tin Sin and a company in Peking, they had battalion headquarters in Hong Kong and a company in Tin Sin, and I suppose a platoon in Peking. We were very lucky, because I think we were about the last regiment to get into China and the first out. Otherwise, we'd still be there now, more or less. And so we went to Hong Kong and mobilised, and that is when I became adjutant. We went down in two ships, sailed from Chin Wang Tao, provided by Jardines. Every soldier was given a packet of cigarettes and a bottle of beer when he marched on board. They were specially converted for troops. And I did a lot of... I had a cabin and an office, and I did a lot of... sort of, I'd been taking over adjutant for about 6 weeks before. This nice colonel who took over from the one I didn't like asked me one day in Tin Sin, I can remember this, I was on the duty orderly officer living in barracks for 24 hours, and he came up to me after lunch and he said, "Oscar, would you like to be adjutant?" I was so overwhelmed with pleasure that I deliberately said, "I want to think about it." Really wanted to grab the opportunity at once. The adjutants, before the war anyway, were very important people. Anyway, I then sort of started studying being adjutant until I took over on arrival in Hong Kong.
What were the functions of the adjutant?
Well, he was chief staff officer of the commanding officer and acted in his name. A very powerful character, and he could tell company commanders what to do, and one frequently did too. I can remember we had a not very outstanding second in command when we were in Hong Kong, and I was preparing embarkation papers for going to wherever we were going. We weren't told. He kept on fiddling about at my desk, and the commanding officer telling him, "Leave poor old Oscar alone and get him on with his job. He knows how to do it. Go away." And you were, an adjutant was a very powerful chap. It really was a sort of step to the staff college and everything else.
What was Hong Kong like compared to the other places you've been to?
We always regarded Hong Kong as being a most sleepy place, where everybody at 10 o'clock God Save the King was played and everybody went to bed. Quite different from what it was when I went back after the war, and what it's like, no doubt, now, where it's a sort of... Well, before the war, Shanghai was always called the Paris of the East. And it was a very gay place in the nicest way of the meaning of the word gay. And Hong Kong is that now, obviously. But we thought it was very pleasant, very sleepy, nice change, nice winter climate. A lot of very agreeable English people who entertained us when we had time to be entertained, nice restaurants. And I wished I'd been able to stay there a bit longer, but being newly appointed adjutant, I was damn busy.
What did the process of mobilisation involve?
Well, that was mostly done by the commanding officer himself, who knew absolutely everything that was going on in the battalion, the most efficient staff officer and commander I think I've ever served under. I sort of ran the administration while he was organising the reorganisation of the various platoons. We had to have a carrier platoon, for instance, which we'd never had before. And putting everybody in what they thought was his right place for war.
How, you say you never had a carrier platoon, how were you provided with one? Did they send the carriers out from England?
We didn't have any. No, we didn't have any, because we were only there for about 3 or 4 weeks,
and then
we sailed
to where?
Suez, but we didn't know it. We were put on board a ship called the Talma. It was a merchantman. I can't remember what line it was, but it was converted for us, and we had an escort, a destroyer escort, and we sailed We stopped at Singapore, as far as I can remember. And I think we did something there. What it was, I can't remember. I think we might have done a bit of training or route marching. We still didn't know where we were going until we got to Suez. And when we got to Suez, I still didn't know where we were going until we said, you're going to Moasca, Ismailia.
Was this... let's get these timings. When did you arrive at Moasca?
January 1940. Delightful place, I thought. One would like to have been stationed there in peacetime. But Ismailia was a very attractive little town on the borders of the Suez Canal, which was the headquarters of the Suez Canal Company. Very French, too. The French club there, where one got met very agreeable meals and so on. There wasn't much else, but lovely swimming and sailing. Horses. We had horse transport enough for people to go riding when they wanted to.
When you got to Egypt, did you find that there was a wartime atmosphere there?
No, we didn't, because the Italians hadn't come in. Although we expected them to come in eventually, they certainly hadn't come in. The Germans, of course, were nowhere near. Oh, God, I'm not...
You were saying you'd expected the Italians to come in, but they hadn't.
Not then. It wasn't even imminent, really, that January or whatever it was, 1940. And, mind you, we kept a jolly good watch on ships going through the canal. And they had these aeroplanes with... anti-mine detectors. They're sort of a great big wheel underneath the fuselage of an aircraft which would sail up and down the canal. I suppose they were supposed to be exploding bombs if there were any mines. I mean, an enormous... The Empress of Canada, I think it was, came in with a contingent from Australia, perhaps. While I was there, I flew over it. I went on board an RAF aircraft and flew down to the end of the Gulf of Aqaba one day and saw this huge ship which had passed through the canal. Gigantic thing it was. They had to be frightfully careful how it got through.
What were you actually doing at Moasca?
Guarding the Suez Canal, presumably. That was the most important thing we had in that part of the world. That was the whole object of the British forces in Egypt, really, was safeguarding the canal.
Did you mount close guards on the canal?
Oh, yes, we did. And actually, when... after a bit, we had a detachment at Suez. I think we might have had a detachment at Kantara, but I'm not sure about that. But certainly, there was quite a... I think there was a company at Suez, at Port Said, and... towards the end of the sort of March, April, the whole battalion moved up into Port Said and barracked in warehouses on the edge of the canal. I can remember the battalion used to dive into the canal sort of for morning PT. And I can remember also being chased by some porpoises once. It was terrifying. They were wanting to play, I suppose. But I wasn't going to be prepared to play with these gigantic fish, and got ashore as soon as I possibly could. And we boarded, I think, as far as I can remember, we boarded every ship that came through, just to show we were in control.
Did you search them as well?
I suppose we must have done, yes. They were all going, a lot of them were going, of course, to Ethiopia. And the moment we heard that the battalions were going in, against us, we stopped a ship. I can't remember what its name was, but it was absolutely stacked full of ammunition and war equipment going to Abyssinia, as we called it in those days, and we captured it. And I always reckoned we ought to have got prize money for that ship, but we never did, of course. The Navy did, of course, but we didn't.
Did you ever come across arms or military stores on any other ship going down to Abyssinia?
Well, we weren't entitled to do anything about it until the war started, and then we got this one ship. We rather delayed her passage through, thinking that something was going to happen, and eventually we managed to stop it. And but after that, of course, they didn't try anymore.
How much did you know about what was going on in Western Europe?
Not a lot, I don't think. I don't think we got a lot of information. Everything was so uncertain. We didn't know really what was going to happen, whether the Italians were going to really do the dirty on us and come in, which they did, just about my time of my birthday. It was June, I think. And we stayed on for a short time. We did, while we were there, I mean, we did an exercise with the Egyptian army, which didn't help very much, I don't think. I hated it. I actually had to act as adjutant to an acting CO who was a liaison with the Egyptian army. I didn't care for it very much. Down in the Suez Desert it was. That was a sort of minor deviation.
What was the Egyptian army like?
They weren't all that cop. I can remember having to do a night march in the middle of the Egyptian army contingent, and some officer or officers in my neighbourhood so stank of the most disgusting perfume that I could hardly make it. It was revolting. But we didn't have very much to do with the Egyptian army. Later on in Mersa Matru, they manned the anti-aircraft guns in our area. But they didn't hardly ever let off. As soon as any aircraft approached, they didn't seem to be there.
Was Maresca near any large town or settlement?
No, only Ismailia, which you could hardly say was a large town. It was a very agreeable little place, built by the French for the French, and quite a nice place, really. Portside, and we were just about halfway between Portside and Suez. Suez is not very nice. Portside was very cosmopolitan and quite fun in a very sort of provincial way.
What sort of area were your battalion covering?
Well, we were covering the northern half of the canal, I suppose.
How did you look after security? Did you have permanent posts on the bank of the canal, or were you doing patrols?
They were patrolling, as far as I can remember, patrolling up and down.
On foot or in vehicles?
Oh, vehicles.
Were there any other alarms or incidents?
No.
Where the battalion had to do anything to?
No. Everything went very peacefully, really. My CO was also the commandant of Portside, and he got acting rank of full colonel. And he spent a lot of his time liaising with the civil authorities and exercising his French, which was rather good because he had a French-speaking wife. And the battalion went on really under me, I suppose, and one or two company commanders. It was a fairly peaceful time, except we were pretty uncomfortable living in warehouses.
How long did this last?
Oh, only a matter of 3 or 4 months, I think. Perhaps 6 at the most. Less, I would say. Yes, I see. We went up to the desert in July, 23rd of July. We went up to Mersa Matru. My ex-CO, the one who I got on so well with, had been transferred to headquarters BTE in Cairo. And I was under who had been his second-in-command, who wasn't really a very effective second-in-command or commanding officer, come to that. He wasn't well, lived on pills.
What's the matter with him?
I don't know. I think he enjoyed bad health. But he was slightly asthmatic, I think, too. He certainly wasn't fit to be a commander in the desert, and later was retired from the job through ill health. But the previous one rang me up one morning when I was in the battalion headquarters, and he said, "Oscar, you're off to MM. I simply couldn't make out what on earth he was talking about. And eventually it transpired it was Mersimer True. And we upped and went in a very short time to Mersimer True.
How did you move up there?
Train.
All the way?
All the way. And we took over from, I think it was the Welsh Regiment, and my opposite now was a chap called Bunny Cowie. And I moved into a dugout, a tomb, in fact. I've got photographs of that. In fact, the photograph of our battalion quarters appeared in, I think it was a Sporting and Dramatic. Anyway, I've got a copy of it here. And also in a book of some, what's the book called? The Army or something or other like that. I've got it in this room. And there was I sitting at a desk on the telephone, simply because somebody rang me up and the photographer wouldn't wait until the conversation finished with our battalion headquarters. Chaps lying about in sort of niches in the rock where the tomb, the coffins had been, and that's where they slept in battalion headquarters. And it was full of fleas. It was the most appalling place. We all had flea powder. And we used to put flea powder in between each layer of our bedding, such as it was. Even so, I was absolutely covered in flea bites, and so much so that I think it was General O'Connor came round to see us, and I had to exhibit my skin to show him what it looked like.
Was he impressed?
I think so, yes. And, of course, the place wasn't safe at all. But everybody thought, you know, it's better to be underground than on top.
Why do you say it wasn't safe?
Well, just one shell on, or bomb on top of the roof would have entombed us.
What was at Mersimer True? What was it like? What sort of place?
Well, it was a defensive position. A beautiful place, looking down to this bay. Marvellous blue colours of the Mediterranean going from sort of purple to pale aquamarine. Lovely swimming, white sand, very white sand. I had to wear dark glasses because it was so brilliant. Bombed every time there was a full moon at night by the Italians, so we dreaded full moons. We weren't there doing that very long because the Italians had come in already. We were in a what was called the Matroux Brigade, and I think latterly a Matroux Fortress, consisted of the 3rd Battalion Coldstream Guards, ourselves, a battalion of South Staffordshire Regiment, and I think a machine gun section or platoon from maybe a company from, I think, the Cheshire Regiment, I'm not certain about that, commanded by an Australian called Brigadier Arthur Selby, who everybody was frightened of. I can't think why, really.
Were you still acting as...
I was still adjutant. And it was really, compared to... the battalion used to bathe in the sea. There was a shortage of water. And we used to do most of our washing in the sea with seawater soap, which didn't seem to do much good. And digging for defences. And that was about all, really. And I can remember, soon after we got there, we had a message from Alexandria District Headquarters, or whatever it was called, saying, any officers who want to go to a private home on leave, please contact such and such an address. And our battalion, before my day, had been stationed in Alexandria and had been very popular indeed there.
This must have been some years earlier.
Oh, yes, 1920s. And they'd had a lovely time there, and there were quite a few families who remembered. Anyway, one of my brother officers, a chap called Adrian Keith, took up this offer and went down to Alexandria, and he stayed with a family called Barker. Cyril Barker and his wife Gabriella, and she was actually born in Trieste, of sort of mixed nationality, Austrian mostly, and she ran a concert party for us, and she had done in the First War. and he had a marvellous time. He went to the concert party whenever he was given the performance. He lived in this very, very comfortable house with bags of servants and wonderful food, lots of civilian friends and so on. He said, well, Oscar, next time you're on leave, you go to that house, it's going to be super. And they'd remember the battalion from the old days. And so next time I went on leave, well, it was the first time, he and I both went and stayed in this house, and we had a super time. She said to us when we arrived, she said, you can do as you please. You can stay with the family or you can go independent, whatever you like. So we decided to stay with the family. We went to the concert party rehearsals and the performances and the delightful girls who were in the thing. It was absolutely marvellous. Of mixed nationality, they all were. English, Swiss, Belgian, Romanian, everything you can think of, practically, except German. And in this delightful house with bags of servants who kept all your clothes clean and looked after you, and attended these concert parties. And we all fell in love with these beautiful girls. Well, anyway, that was a side performance, but I went on staying at that house every time I had leave when I was in the Middle East and afterwards when I was in Palestine. And then we had the Battle of Sidi Barani, which was very well conducted. No one knew it was going to happen at all. Part of the battalion, under the new CO, because I told you the other one had been invalided out because of ill health, the new CO was my original company commander, a South African, immensely brave, and quite impossible to understand what he was doing.
What was that?
He, one of these soldiers who wanted to be in the leading section every time anything was happening, and so and never remembered to tell anybody where he was.
Did and he ever tell you what he intended to do?
Oh, no, never. And he used to sort of stalk out of the headquarters and get into the nearest vehicle, whoever it belonged to, and just drive off into the wilderness, and then possibly walk home, forgetting and he'd taken the vehicle. Very difficult. Especially for an adjutant who had to know where he was and what his intentions were. Well, anyway, we did some exercises as dictated to by Corps headquarters, I suppose. And without knowing it, it was a rehearsal for the attack of Sidi Barani, which I certainly knew nothing at all.
What form did these exercises take?
Well, I wasn't on them. I was at the CO went off with a company, or perhaps two companies, and they would had these dummy tanks, which they were placing out in the desert and doing all sorts of manoeuvres. And apparently they came back after the first time and were told they'd done damn badly and they got to do it all over again, which, of course, was the real thing. And they did do it all over again, and I didn't know what was happening until we had a message from GHQ or